This morning, we find ourselves back in Sydney, down on the waterfront in the neighbourhood known as The Rocks. The sun is shining on this beautiful Sydney morning in January, right beneath the approach to the Sydney Harbour Bridge. The area is not yet busy with tourists, and you can sit and have a quiet cappuccino at one of the dozens of excellent cafes that crowd into the historic heart of Sydney. This is the starting point for most tourists. It contains a number of museums and historic monuments, and in spite of being a bit of a tourist trap and rather expensive, has some of the best views of Sydney Harbour. There are no hidden secrets in the name. The area was called The Rocks because the land was, well, very rocky. This is the spot where white man's Australia, that is, European Australia, British Australia, first began. It's the very core of Sydney, and the character and nature of the city can't be understood without looking back at its beginnings. British criminals, convicts, and undesirables had for many years been ejected from Britain and dumped in North America. When the American War of Independence inconveniently interrupted this traffic, it proved necessary to find another penal colony and dumping ground. The newly discovered Australia provided just the right opportunity. Australia's east coast was discovered in 1770 by the British explorer Captain Cook, the first European to set eyes on the continent. In January 1788, midsummer, the first fleet of ships bringing convicts arrived with 730 prisoners of both sexes and 400 sailors. From the very beginning, the nature of the city and its future socio-economic divide was literally set in stone. The prisoners were allocated the poor rocky land to the west of the freshwater stream, while the captain of the fleet and other high-ranking officers took the better land to the east. Captain Arthur Phillip, as he was called, knew a good opportunity when he saw it, and he appointed himself as Australia's first governor. The convicts were forced to work, building roads, farms and government buildings, whilst continuing to live in squalor on the rocks. Governor Phillip believed in the colony and saw a future in it, but he understood the need to attract new free settlers. The convicts were then assigned to the new settlers as labourers. In time, convicts themselves were also granted land and gradually earned their freedom, but not the freedom to return to Britain. Theirs was a one-way ticket. The British often joke that the Australians are a nation of criminals, and in Sydney's case, there's a real truth to this. Between 1788 and 1842, when the transportation of convicts to Sydney largely ceased, 150,000 rejects from Britain were dumped in the colony. The Australian character is known for its lack of pretension and formality. The language is freely peppered with slang and swear words, and nowhere is this more true than in Sydney. At first, most of the other new settlers were sailors and whalers. The Rocks gradually became a giant dirty slum, overcrowded, with almost as many brothels and drinking dens as houses. Sewage ran down the streets, not only from the dwellings of the Rocks themselves, but also from the more bourgeois houses that had begun to appear on the slopes above. Excrement flowed down into the freshwater stream and into the harbour, and in 1900, Sydney had its worst outbreak of bubonic plague, killing 103 people. This led to the clearing of the slums and the start of a new phase of construction. Downtown Sydney had already acquired many grand government buildings, but with the coming of independence in 1901, a new sense of patriotism gave the expansion of the city a new urgency. The start of the construction of the Harbour Bridge in the 1920s took the building fever across the harbour to the North Shore. However, along with the disappearance of the slums, went a part of Australia's colonial history. It wasn't really until the 1970s that the value of a cultural heritage and a pride in Australia's national identity looked to rediscover the past. The Rocks began to be transformed into a heritage site, and in the 1990s, a large part of the neighbourhood was unearthed under a car park. This site is now open to the public as an open-air museum, and you can once again tread some of the original cobblestones of the Rocks. But let's jump back again in time to 1851. Sydney had been the only penal colony and European settlement in Australia until 1803, when a second penal colony was established in Tasmania. Over the next 40 years, the incursion into Australia's interior was a very gradual process. But in 1851, gold was discovered about 200 kilometres inland from Sydney. And shortly afterwards, in the far south of the colony, near the little settlement of Melbourne. The goldfields in this part of New South Wales, as it was then, that later separated to become the state of Victoria, were far bigger. Suddenly, Australia had a gold rush on its hands, and it was the tiny port of Melbourne that became the main point of transit into and out of the goldfields. For the first time, Sydney lost its position as number one town to Melbourne. It's difficult to understand Sydney without understanding Melbourne, and vice versa. The two most important Australian cities are still locked in a rivalry that has lasted since the 1850s. If the gold rush hadn't happened, Melbourne might have remained a tiny and insignificant town. But as it turned out, things happened a little differently. Melbourne went from a population of 23,000 in 1850 to an astonishing 500,000 just 40 years later. By 1890, it was the second largest city in the British Empire after London. It had a state-of-the-art tram system, the first trains in Australia, huge impressive Victorian public buildings to rival London, churches, cathedrals, schools, libraries and art galleries. It was like Victorian England in the Southern Hemisphere. It was the Dubai of its day, built not on oil, but on the wealth of a gold rush that lasted for 40 years. In short, it was bigger, better, and a whole lot more sophisticated than Sydney. But the inevitable happened, and the gold rush came to an end. Melbourne entered a cycle of economic boom and bust, swinging between expansion and recession in the early years of the 20th century. It remained Australia's largest city, and in 1901 became the first capital of the newly independent country. Melbourne continues to regard itself as more sophisticated than Sydney. It was never populated by convicts, and its art and culture scene was always greater than that of Sydney. It was partly to resolve this bitter rivalry between the two that the decision was taken to establish a new and neutral capital. This became the city of Canberra, halfway between Sydney and Melbourne, and set in its own federal district, much like Washington, D.C. When Melbourne finally lost its status as capital city in 1927, the Sydney Harbour Bridge was already under construction, and that iconic structure set the tone for the ascendance of Sydney, which has dominated Melbourne ever since. Sydney is once again the largest Australian city, with 4.75 million people, and the most recognisable symbol of urban Australia. But the battle with Melbourne is not over. Melbourne, with 4.35 million, is now growing faster than Sydney and is forecast to reach a population of 5 million in the next two decades. The competition to see who can build higher, faster, better continues to fascinate observers.